Session number 26590, General Wilhelm Mayer, Reel 1.
Mayer, Reel 1. General, can you tell me if there's any history of military service in your family background?
Well, I had an uncle who was part-time. He wasn't a regular, but he did a certain amount of military service. But that was on my mother's side. My mother's father was really a minister, and they were inclined and academic in that way. No, I wouldn't say we have military. Now, my background really is from Belgium, for one place, and very commercial minded. I'm really brought up in a Bergen, very typical Bergen environment. And outlook on military in Bergen is somewhat different from most other places in Norway. The only military we really had traditionally are the old, what we call Buerkorps, which were youngsters teaming up and making formations of company and battalion and so on. They have colorful picture in the Bergen milieu, but they trained with the place in Norway where they had that sort of thing. It's a colourful thing, particularly on the 17th of May. That is, you know, our national day.
This would be
I didn't belong to it. I was a scout myself.
This was a sort of youth corps, militarized
youth corps. Yes. Yeah. Quite interesting. It's an old tradition, and it's really. But Bergen are commercial people more than shipping people, fishing, commercial people, and I belong to that group.
Can you remember when it was you were first attracted to the idea of flying and aviation?
Oh, that's very old. I know that my grandfather was very apt to be early on the first cars that ever came to the country. My father was keen on that, and I was, I suppose I'm just technically interested. And I came early. My first flying trip was really back in, I think it was 28, up in Trondheim. I've been bitten by that bug from very early, and it stayed on.
What about the idea of military flying? When did that first come into your mind as a possible way
well,
of
I
life?
Wasn't really, I was really, when I took Artium, I was really wanting to be an engineer, an aeronautical engineer. But I was also set on flying as such, and military flying seems to be the way to do it. We didn't have much civilian offers and that, but it was military flying, yes. I applied for the Army, and I also applied for the Navy, and I was accepted in the Army. This was in 1936, and a week later I was accepted for the Navy. But then I was up in the Army already, so that was it. As far as I'm concerned, I could might as well be a naval aviator as an army aviator.
Do I take it then there was no air force as such at that time?
No, like in most countries, you know, the way aviation came, you know, they were kind of peculiar apparatus. People didn't really know what they did, and it was quite natural that both the army and the navy see what's in it for me, and they started out that way. So it was in the war that. We were made into one separate service.
When you were in the Boy Scouts, did you learn anything that was later useful to you as a soldier and as an airman?
No, I think teamwork and general companionship among people who have some interest and so on. No, otherwise, I remember that period as a good period, yes, but whether I could identify any. No, I wouldn't say so. Outdoor life, of course, I've always been very happy about that. And
surviving in the open and living in the woods.
Yeah, skiing and so on.
You were accepted by the Army in 1936. What happened next? Were you called up to do a specific training scheme?
Well, I went to flying school from 36 to 37, which was, as I said, the Army flying school. But it was really very independent, though. We didn't have much connection with the Army as such. In the Navy, they had more connection between... if you were a Navy pilot, you were basically a naval officer. If you were an Air Force pilot, or as it was, an Army pilot, you were, like the Americans too, you were basically that, and not an Army man, really. But when I had taken the flying school, the I was still pursuing the business of engineering. And I would be honest, it wasn't of military interest as such, as much as I simply thought that, well, the market is small and so on for civilian engineering, aeronautical engineering, and to be in with the survey, with the state and so on, is probably a good thing. And it was 2 years, and I thought, I was early out, so I thought, well, now I can do that before I go, and so I did that. And then at the end of that, of course, the war came. So that sent me on that track.
What was the selection process for entry to the Army Air Corps at that time? What sort of examinations and tests did you have to pass to be accepted in 1936?
I would say just about the same as today. We had less of psychologists. We had more people of the practical thing. Well, they do have that today too. We had the washout system like we have today in the Air Force, which of course is a pretty tough thing, and it has a side effect, of course, is that you lose a lot of applicants that say that the risk of failing is too high, and they can lose out on other sort of education. And failing can be a lot of things, you know, talent or not necessarily negative things on the person, it's just that they don't fit in on it.
You said the sort of tests they have today, without the psychology, would that be interviews, or would it be written academic tests or practical tasks? What sort of tests were you put to?
Well, it was a lot of interviews, yes, and physical things, physical testing, medical background, and of course the normal thing with eyes and ears, and you know, your senses operate, and how quick you are on reactions, and just the way it is today.
What was the washout system? I don't quite understand that term.
Well, we had a washout system almost set by budget. We were 18 that was admitted to the flying school, and 4 had to go. They didn't have money enough to take them all, even if they were qualified. And this, of course, if you all were almost qualified, it's a little hard to say who's got to leave and on what reasons. So it set a very high competitive idea into the system. But I wouldn't say that that competitive idea spoiled the comradeship or friendship as a team. It didn't. But it was just a very competitive sort of situation. And 4 had to leave, and we knew that. Who would they be?
What sort of criteria were they applying when they chose the 4 who had to be washed out?
Well, to be quite honest, we don't know. Sometimes it could be some disciplinary thing that was just short, and sometimes you had a feeling that they were looking for something that you could differentiate the one from the other. So. But in other cases, it was just simply that they weren't talented to fly, and then it was fairly easy.
Do you think that the ability to fly and to fly well is a natural talent that is inborn, or is it a skill that can be taught and developed by training?
Well, it can be taught a long way, but I would say that unless you have a talent for it, you shouldn't do it anyway. For one thing, you wouldn't have the fun of it, which is part of being enthusiastic about it. And secondly, I would say that you can be taught it. I've seen good pilots in war that had a hard time really taking the flying side, but were very good at war on their sort of business, depending on where they were. So there's no straight answer, but I would have a talent for flying, yes, because you are required. You get into a situation where you really need to have that to take you out of it. Yes.
You mentioned that you had detailed medical examinations. Was flying in those days a more physical business than it is today?
Well, we had less G in those days. We had hard Gs those days too. I mean, you can lose your eyesight and so on heavy G, but today the G is of a different nature, as you know. We have this called the rapid G onset, which is takes you away unconscious for about 22 seconds, you know. We had also blackouts and that sort of thing, but not of that strong nature. Now, another thing, that of course has to do with the physical build-up.
The pulmonary system.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Now, what was the question, really? What
about whether flying was physically more demanding.
Yeah,
then?
Of course you also have, in those days, you didn't have the instrumentation on the airplanes. So it was more like flying on the pants of your, as it was called. Mm. Of course you had... You couldn't do the same thing in those days as you can today. Your flying, your navigation was... Today people are very much sort of... They've got to be very talented on using information that comes from outside, interpret instruments, and all those sort of modern things. We didn't have that, but then we didn't do the same thing.
Did you have to exert physical strength to control the aircraft?
I think the requirement is such.
Yes.
It doesn't make one better today than older. You can just do it much more things because of technicalities.
Because
the human nature is about the same.
It's not a matter of quality, it's a matter of different techniques.
I
know that in the early aircraft, in the First World War aircraft, and those in the early 1920s, you had to have a considerable amount of physical strength to actually pull the controls.
Yeah.
And you had to have a high level of fitness to cope with the effects of altitude, such as the cold and the thinning of the air.
Mm. Oh, yes, there's a lot of those things. Mm. I remember that was during the war, because you sit down as we were at Northfield, warm summer day, you're sitting lightly clad, you scramble, you run up, and of course you go to sleep, right up like this and so on. You get things on and you run right up there, and it's minus an awful lot of things. You can see it, even on the sweaty sort of thing, you can see it freezes on you. It's a different life. And no pressure cabins, of course, and that sort of thing. It's a totally different life.
When you started training in 1936, where did that take place?
At Keller, which is a little outside, little north of there. There's an airfield there. It's still there. It's the main depot at the present time. There's a strip.
What was the syllabus of training for that 2 years?
Well, we got about... it was 1 year flying school. We got about 220 hours in the year. We used mainly Tiger Moth, which was a wonderful airplane for that purpose. We had some of the old standard Moth, which was a little earlier version, but mainly it was Tiger Moth. They had the very basic instruments, no Horizon, for example, but they had the turn and bank in kit. It was very basic. It's still a mess. They're still flying it, but, that's a good training outfit.
Did they start you with the practical side of flying straight away, or did you have to learn an element of theory before you first sat in a cockpit and took off?
We had a sort of recruit school, which was sort of whetting your appetites. But we got into the flying fairly quickly. We started in summer. As a matter of fact, the Army War College that I went to at that time wasn't really... I went on that because... I was at the end of the Army War College. I was called out away from it, even before it was finished, because the war came and so on. But at the flying school, I went the regular way. It was about a year. And as I say, we got about 220 hours. We ended up flying the Fokker airplane, which was type. That was really a 24 model, but we manufactured them ourselves on license. And that was a basic airplane that we had. I also got on the Gladiator at the time, but I didn't got that later. It was just a transfer to Gladiator at the end of the flying school. It's a wonderful airplane. And we had a Scimitar too, a wonderful airplane for aerobatics and so on, tremendous. But I never flew them during the war.
You're saying you did about 220 hours flying. After how many hours did you first start going solo?
Well, I think I had something like 8.5 hours or something like that.
With an instructor?
It varied. Some people are slower to it and some people are to it. It doesn't mean that one is getting better than the other. It's a little about how quickly. So it depends a little on the instructor too, you know.
Of course. So you had 8.5 hours of instruction under flying under instruction, and then you were solo.
Yeah, and then you go solo, and then you're back to instruction, and then you do more advanced flying and so on. But this business of going solo at the appropriate time is rather important for your self-confidence. Okay? Mm. And we won't hide that there wasn't anybody that didn't go behind a friendly crowd and did their own tryouts and so on, you know. Mm. Couldn't be seen from the ground, and you learned a lot from that. That's part. Every nation does the same thing.
When you were going on to more advanced flying, what were you learning in the advanced flying course that you didn't learn on the basic flying? Was there new skills and new things you were learning?
Well, one thing in Norway that was very typical is that you had to abide with the season of change. So while you learned on wheels and the autumn weather, in the autumn, snow come and ice freezes, and you put skis on your airplane. You've got to live with the airplane. And one thing that we did, we had a special winter exercise that took about 3 weeks and so on. We moved away and just stayed out on a lake and flew, and we did various sort of things, formation flying, for example, all these basic things. But we also learned very much to really live with the airplane. It was part of the thing, for example, that you were sent off to land somewhere else where there was just nothing. I mean, you just landed, and you were two, not one, two seats. And then you just had to be yourself, like the cameraman and his horse, you know. You just had to take care of the airplane, get the heating elements under it and so on, which is a kind of a briquette that you heated up and so on, and then you had to cover it up, and you had to do a lot of things, and you tag it down, and you had to sleep yourself out. You know, you just find a hole in the snow and do things. And next morning, starting it and so on again, you know, and get home. That was part of the trade, and a very enjoyable part of the trading too. And of course, if weather changed, then it could change and so on. You could get stuck for a while in exercises of that kind. But it was, we never had any mishaps about it. No sort of frantic rescue operation or something. You know. We got very used to live with the airplane in the winter and conditions.
And flying and living in the field. Mm. This is these are the basic skills of the bush pilot, aren't they?
Yeah, you can say it that way.
Mm. How did you actually navigate? What was the main method of navigation?
Map
on the knee.
Yeah.
Did you have good maps that were detailed for the terrain?
Yes. And then, of course, in Norway, you don't have many railways. So you find one, you know pretty well where you are. If you find a river, you know pretty well where you are. The railways are that kind. Mm. On the other hand, we have pretty rough terrain, as you know. So this business of reading on the map and following down, you can get stuck up in fairly steep weathers.
Mm. Mm. The weather can be changeable as well, can't it, in certain areas?
Depending on where you are.
Rapidly
not so much
changeable.
Here, but on the up north and on the west coast, yes. Mm. Mm. And you have icing conditions. That's the sort of thing you have to learn to live with.
Mm. How do you cope with icing if you start getting iced up?
Get home in time. Stay out of it, you know. Mm. But if necessary, you have to. Get. We had no de-icing equipment, for example. So you just had to do that.
Did you fly over the sea as well as over land as part of your training?
Oh, yes, we did. Especially during that neutrality guard period when you were at war, but we weren't. And so I was staying up at Trondheim at that time. This was after the war college here. I was stationed up there. We flew Fokkers. We had patrols over the sea all the time. Mm. And I must give credit to the mechanics. I can never remember anybody ever having a mishap on the engines. And you were staying out for 6 or 7 hours, you know, just patrolling over the roughest sea you can find. With the old Fokker, you could see the sort of things on the radial engines there. What do you call them, the things on?
Pistons.
Yeah, not the pistons, but the tappets. You could see them start there, and you had that sound all the time. I never heard anybody have any problem. It was a cheetah engine. panther and cheetah. British engines, and Whistler made them. This is a commercial.
Yes, of course. Are there different techniques that have to be employed when flying over water to flying over the land? Or is it basically the same sort of?
Well, our land is not flat, you know, and you have to watch out all the time for that sort of thing. And of course, it gives a lot of turbulence. But over the sea, you have misty weather, and islands prop up pretty quick and pretty rough on you. So you've got to keep your navigation awfully clever, not to run into. Especially, we have a lot of islands all along the coast and so on. And they can be hard to see unless you're close up on them. You have to fly low, so you have
to have your wits about you. Have to have your wits about you.
Yeah, it takes simply good airmanship to live in that. And there's no sort of, in those days it wasn't a sort of climb out. You had trouble to fly the Fokker blind on instruments. I tell you, that took some doing. The Tiger Moth was easier, but of course, that was a school plane. But instrument flying wasn't what instrument flying is today. Well, radio and navigation wasn't what it is today. So.
What were the characteristics of the Fokker? Was it a biplane?
It had a small stud wing underneath, lower one, and a top, fairly bigger top wing. We had two versions. We called one the Reconnaissance Scout. Fokker, that had a bigger wing, and the other one was what we called the Fokker Fighter. It wasn't much of a fighter, really, when you think of it. There was a little difference in engine size, had about 600 horsepower. It was good for its time in 1924, but that's what it was.
What was its armament?
Well, we had a machine gun facing forwards within the system of sort of constant Denosco gear. We're actually shooting the bullet through the propellers, not through the hub of the propeller, but some of them. The Hispano Suiza system was shooting in there.
but
we had it so that the machine gun was triggered by the rotation of the propeller, the RPM. And so it would never hit the blade, it would go in between the two. Quite an ingenious gear. Of course, it slowed down the machine gun. But the bombing and so on, we did train on that. We made a special system on that. That sounds queer when you think about it. We had this observer, navigator, radio operator, ticking, sitting behind in the gun ring and on the Fokker. And he had a hole in the bottom, and you would fly over the target, and he would sort of look at it, the target coming up like this. Of course, the speed was about 160 miles per hour or something. And as he was just on top of it, he would knock the pilot on the shoulder. You know, the pilot would pull up in an imminent, like that. And as he turned over, and the airplane was literally standing still, in all directions, he would drop the bomb, and it would fall absolutely straight. We call it Rundup, which was an amazing accuracy, actually. But it took that, you saw the target well, and you had to have a certain amount of altitude to do it. And it was fun doing, but the value of it, I don't think anybody used it anymore.
Did you do a lot of practice at air gunnery while you were in your training?
Yes, we did. Also forward gun. We didn't have any. We had just a bear and bud sight. Ring in the thing. There was nothing. We did.
What sort of targets did they provide for you to shoot at? Did they have towed screen targets?
Yes, and we had also stationary targets on the ground. We were supposed to do army support work, you know. So
close air support.
That sort of thing. And we were dropping small bombs by mission site, just everything. And one thing we did was also, the army put up two poles, like a goal on a football thing, and a string across, and the string contained the message. And so you came around and picked up this by your undercarriage, you know, just flew so loud that you took that thing, so it brought along with you your the message, you know. Mm.
Yes. Did you have any way of getting information to the ground when you were flying?
I just dropped it.
You dropped it?
No. We just had a special little dropping envelope for that, which as you dropped it, it folded itself out so you could see it well when it came down.
Yes.
Find it easy. A little weight in it too, so it wasn't carried away by the wind. So.
Yes. What about aerial reconnaissance by photography? Did you practice that?
Yes, we did, yes. Mm. And we did that in flying school too. That was really one of the bigger testing, to say, make reconnaissance on the negative railway station, come back and register how many are there and how they were, and you know, the timing of the trains and the amount of traffic, you know, the amount of wagons that was pulling in. And the clarity by which you could make a sort of a map, you know, and so on, part of training.
You were saying that you spent 1 year learning to fly, and this is, you joined in 1936, so presumably you graduated from flying school in 1937, went on to the Fokker. What happened to you after you'd finished your flying training? Did you go straight to a squadron somewhere? Or?
Yes, we. You could choose in a way, within reason. But if you got out fairly reasonably ahead in the class, you had a priority. Mm. And in those days, to get to Trondheim was the sort of things that people did, you know. I selected Trondheim, and I got to Trondheim, and that was it. Of course, some others were, you could almost say, luckier. They went here and they flew gladiators. And so, mm-hmm. Well, I didn't do that. I went to Trondheim somewhere, some reason or another. I wanted to go to Trondheim. Mm-hmm. But Trondheim was a very favored place to be. It was a very good place to be.
What were the advantages of Trondheim? What was it that attracted you?
Well, it was a different part of the country, for one thing. I just liked it. I just liked a bit there. That's it. Mm. We didn't have at my time anything up north. If we had, I probably would have wanted to do that. Mm. But Trondheim was an established place. It's a nice area. And we liked it there. Everybody seemed to be happy there. Not only pilots and navigators and so on, but ground crew and everybody. It depended a lot. And we had a tremendous fine boss, chief of the
Sorry, we've run out.